sometimes becoming dependent upon healthcare is inherently part of the process of the healthcare procedures. So this is something that needs to be considered. Because there's this massive industry, often grown out of the individual's abuse of himself or the neglect of his loved ones without being of greater service to them, this healthcare system is in a position to charge anything it wants. And so, in the final analysis, however, from a theosophical perspective, a person trying to grow in certain ways has to start by educating himself and taking responsibility along the lines of healthcare. This brings some people out in the world to alternative means of healing when they can't afford the regular standard types. And that's where things like mental / psychic healing / spiritual healing will start to come in. And we're warned, we're encouraged to educate ourselves and to share some ideas with folks along those lines. So for purposes of today's talk, we're going to consider mental healing, metaphysical healing, mind cure. There's all sorts of different labels that are put, maybe slight nuances to each one, but fundamentally, they're all the same. Fundamentally, Mr. Judge says really there's no difference between them nor a basis upon which they are grounded. What they all have in common simply is hypnotism. These forms of metaphysical healing are hypnotism in one form or of another, either hypnosis of oneself through affirmations or denials that I don't really have this infection when it's there, or affirmation that no, I really am healthy and I know I'm healthy when you're laying in bed and you can't get out. It's not to say that affirmations and denials don't have an effect on the symptoms. But the question is, as a theosophist, are we finding out what the cause is and making appropriate adjustments as best we can? These approaches can sometimes actually be formulas, which take the mind off the body because it's generally not understood by these healers who practice it. These formulas will be almost in the sense of spells that will be used no matter what your symptoms are. And it's thought that it has to do with how we think. Well, how we think brings about certain symptoms in our health. However, thinking your way out of it is a completely different issue, because when we're talking about metaphysical healing, that's not thought. That's not a process of thought. That is manipulating certain currents of the body. It's manipulating elementals. It's not just thinking about it. It's also visualization, and it's dabbling in the metaphysical. Now, we all know that the third object of the Theosophical movement is the investigation of the hidden forces of nature and those forces that are latent within man that correspond. But there we're talking about the investigation to further understand, not to dabble in the metaphysics of it if we don't know what we're doing, because it can be far more dangerous. So we need to inquire into these systems from the point of view of theosophy and ask ourselves, as a result of doing this method, am I learning more about myself? Am I learning more about the laws of nature? Am I taking the next step in having a fuller realization of who I am and how to live a better life? If I'm proceeding along a certain practice and I can't answer those questions in the affirmative, then we have to question whether or not it's in line with theosophy to do this. We're not knocking anybody, but it fails the test of is it a theosophical approach. if I'm not learning something about it. Well, who wouldn't be attracted to these systems of metaphysical healing if it promised to heal disease? And often it certainly does work in terms of symptoms. Well, but let's talk about the cause. Does it help us deal with the cause? There's no specific metaphysical method that is a cure-all. There's no panacea, because all the different diseases have different causes. Of course, diseases can be the result of bad habits, and we can make adjustments there by replacing bad habits with good habits. It can be a matter of poor nutrition, and we would know how to satisfy that. It could even be improper hygiene, or even nervous diseases caused by stressing out too much about things that don't matter. And it would seem a student of theosophy from time to time will recognize that in himself, and the indigestion or the problems that we have that are going on. If we put these big problems in perspective, the body will take care of itself. The healing process will happen in many cases without having to go and pay to somebody to do it for us. So, Mr. Crosby tells us that a diseased body, simply, which is 7 billion people on the planet, more or less, a diseased body simply represents ignorance of our own nature. If we lived according to the laws of nature, these diseases would not be upon us. So perhaps disease is nature's way of waking us up to certain lessons that it's time to learn. Yet these methods of healing, if it doesn't force us or require us or incent us to learn more about ourselves or to learn more about nature, but it does relieve the symptoms, then really it's relieving us of taking responsibility for our symptoms and growing because we've learned how to manage them. So one among many topics that we might talk about today would have to do with the use of mind and metaphysical practices to cause a cure of symptoms, the effect of which is not to cure one's nature, but is just to make the symptoms go away, and it works. And what Mr. Judge tells us is that it will take the very disease that's causing the symptoms, which may have been put in motion in earlier lives, but never really came to the fore because the conditions weren't ready, and forces it back into our inner nature. So then we're just gonna have to wait for the conditions to arise again, for this disease to manifest again, and we're told it'll manifest more virulently, and having forced it for personal selfish reasons, it's gonna come back tainted with that. When, on the other hand, it had already been at the physical, it was so close to being purged from the being once and for all. The message here is consider letting it flow through rather than using metaphysical or psychic methods of healing. And the effect can be that you're done with it for life and for lives. So these are some of the ideas that are presented as regards psychic metaphysical healing. But there's another approach that the human being may take, and that's what we're going to hear from in the second speaker today.
Did you turn
this
off?
I did.
Okay.
Did you turn it off?
Oh, it's on. It's on.
Okay. So the first presentation had to deal with misconceptions of mental and spiritual healing, because they're often approached from the psychic point of view, and also engender psychic forces and faculties in the human being. The second presentation will look at the same subject of mental and spiritual healing, but from the spiritual point of view. And so if there is a true system of mental and spiritual healing, it has to be based on knowledge of the laws of the mental and spiritual departments of nature, as well as the physical laws of our being. Notice the emphasis there on laws. And as you can well imagine and probably realize, there are hundreds of references and many articles on this broad, far-reaching subject. So in the attempt to present these ideas in any systematized way in a short period of time, we're going to use a approach where we're going to present three principles of mental and spiritual healing and seven laws of mental and spiritual healing, which are applications of those principles. So we'll talk first about the three principles of mental and spiritual healing. What is a principle? A principle is a basis of thought and action. So these principles are bases from which one can think and act in a healthy and therapeutic way. So the first principle to realize is the operation of the law of cause and effect in health and healing. And here, the fundamental cause of health and healing is right thought. Because right thought leads to right conduct, right understanding, and right progress. And why is this important? Right conduct means thinking in accordance with laws of healing. Right understanding means thinking in accordance with the real nature of our being, our immortal, permanent nature. And right progress means thinking in accordance with the laws of our physical, mental, and spiritual growth. So thought is the key. Well, the second principle then is the operation of the law of cause and effect in the production of disease. And here we realize that there are three causes of most diseases that affect humanity. And the first cause is faulty imagination, which can be healed by envisioning the highest ideals. The second cause is fear and doubt, which can be healed by the renunciation of the desire for personal reward. And the third cause is ignorance and delusion, which can be healed by knowledge. So notice that thought is instrumental in health and healing, and thought, or the misuse or abuse of thought, is instrumental in the cause of disease. The third principle then is the three streams of evolution and progress are the physical, mental, and spiritual streams. Therefore, healing and health is achieved and maintained when all these are pursued in a harmonious manner in accordance with laws of nature, laws of the universal unity and interdependence of life, cycles, and karma. In other words, we have to keep in mind that we are threefold beings evolving along threefold streams and to act in ways which keep this progress harmonious and balanced. So now we come to the seven laws of mental and spiritual healing. And there are perhaps many others, but once again, we're trying to systematize this broad subject in a way we can handle it this morning. So the first law will say has to deal with physical health and healing. And here the law is to practice moderation in all things for physical health and healing. This relates to moderation in our activity and rest, moderation in diet, moderation in exercise, and interestingly enough, moderation in cleanliness. Because once again, we don't want to have an extreme lack of cleanliness, but we know an excessive concern of cleanliness can also be an indicative of some type of imbalance in the mind. So, what is the idea here? Physical health is maintained and acquired by living naturally. And what we mean by that is living in harmony with laws of hygiene in order that the imbalance or dis-ease in the body does not bias the mind or obscure the action of spirit. So the body needs care, because the body is an instrument which needs to be kept in order so the mind and spiritual nature can use it as an instrument. But as pointed out, that does not mean we need to overly dwell on the mind and its health and healing and disease, but try to keep the mind on its own plane of thought and awareness. Focus on ideas, thoughts, feelings. The second, third, and fourth laws have to do more with mental healing and health. How do we maintain and acquire mental health and heal ourselves in a true fashion? The second law would be to cultivate concentration or one-pointedness. The second law would be to cultivate concentration or one-pointedness so that the lower tendencies of mind that can lead to faulty imagination, fear and doubt, or perturb the body and mind may be controlled. So remember, faulty imagination, fear and doubt are causes of concentration, of disease. So the cultivation of one-pointedness helps keep our mind focused on high ideals, helps keep our mind focused on the right kind of desire, and therefore eliminates the tendencies, the shifting tendencies of mind that dwell on memories that are unpleasant or future expectations which are feared and thereby bring up mental disturbances. Now, we need to realize why this cultivation of concentration is so important, because thought is a spiritual power that goes beyond just the formulation of ideas, because the spiritual power of thought affects the life all around us, the life, the sensitive points of consciousness in our own bodies, as well as great nature. And we receive the reaction from the lives in our body and that of great nature through this spiritual power of thought, whether the thought be incorrect, misled, or truthful. And as was pointed out, when we focus too much attention or concentrate on the body in a personal, self-centered way, it interferes with the normal operation and increases the disease. We think any of you who've tried to think very intently about a skill you already know, it can interfere. Like just trying to think about the process of walking, so focused on it that it almost becomes awkward. And many of the systems of so-called mental and spiritual healing, they work because the mind is taken off the body, off the concerns of the illness, and that in itself can bring along a certain healing. And we know the whole area of psychosomatic illnesses, where the mind is focused so intently on certain worries and concerns that it actually produces this physical disease in the body. The third law related to mental healing is to cultivate high desires and aspirations, because this will arouse and direct the will to bring about the desired result. And if the will is not strong, we cannot maintain our highest ideals in our imagination, and we cannot maintain our noblest intentions. So we need strong will to do that. So we do that by cultivating high desires. The fourth law that also relates to mental healing is to raise the lower mind with its thought and feeling by the higher mind with its thought and feeling. That means, even if we know that we have lower thoughts and feelings, to try to put them in the service of a higher purpose. In the voice of the silence, it says to make pride and self-regard bondmaidens to devotion. So let's say we think a lot about our diet, or we think a lot about our job, or we think a lot about our family, to think about it in a way that's, quote, theosophical, to understand it in terms of its higher value, that we maintain the body so it can be a truthful instrument. We are concerned about our families because our families are the basic unit of universal brotherhood, and we want to maintain a nucleus there. In other words, to think about even common factors from a universal higher perspective. So we see here that mental health is maintained and acquired by exercising the faculties of mind, thought, will, feeling, imagination, and memory in such a way as to unite it to the spiritual nature. So we've talked so far about physical healing, one law, the second, third, and fourth about mental healing. Now when we come to spiritual healing and health, this is different because, in a sense, the immortal spiritual nature cannot be diseased. So you can't heal it. But the action and influence of the spiritual nature on the mind and thus on the body can be obscured, can be blocked, just like the rays of the sun can be blocked by clouds. And that blocking, that obscuration, can produce mental, moral, and physical disturbances. So spiritual health is maintained and acquired by avoiding that which obscures the influence of the spiritual nature and the mind and the body. And we'll summarize these fifth, sixth, and seventh laws real briefly in a sentence or two, so we have plenty of time for discussion. The fifth law is to avoid the indulgences of the senses, of indulging our senses. And that has to do not only with the physical senses, but also the psychic senses. And we know this is brought out again and again in the Bhagavad Gita. The sixth law is to avoid the undisciplined satiation of the desires, the going after and the fulfilling of our lusts and desires with abandon is the one extreme that the Buddha warns against. But to And on the other hand, not to be so extreme that we become unnecessary ascetics and deprive the body, but to find some middle way of relating to our desires that does not obscure the spiritual. And the seventh law, of course, has to do with the avoidance of any kind of thought or idea that creates the illusion in our minds of separateness. So these three laws constitute what it means for spiritual healing in the sense of avoiding those thoughts or desires or sensations that obscure the action of spirit on our mental and physical nature. Because the spiritual nature is always healing if it can come through. So we'll stop here and hopefully the ideas presented this morning from both points of view have raised lots of questions and comments.
Yes.
Well, one phrase that we keep in mind and we make sure that we identify them. Honor thy mother and thy father, that thy days may be long on earth. And by the way, we think of but I have a feeling that refers to a higher concept of my father and mother. That our days may be longer. It means to tell me that we seek time away.
Well, honor thy father and mother so that thy days be long upon the earth. Let's look at that from the point of view, if we do not honor or give respect or proper gratitude to a benefactor, a teacher, a supporter, whether they be a spiritual teacher or even our physical parents, that very act sets up a obstruction in our nature, which leads to, quote, spiritual disease. In other words, a certain spiritual nature, part of our nature, cannot come through. And that generates certain causes in our mind and as a result in our body, which are productive of our disease. Remember, all disease that manifests in the body at one point had its origin in the mind, in the way we think. So what are the consequences of disrespect? What are the consequences of dishonoring something, of not showing gratitude? Well, the opposite, those opposite tendencies that would be in our nature because we have not cultivated, are clearly prejudicial, biased, and not only affect others, but ourselves as well.
Yes.
In all of this, our attitude, not has to be a determining factor. And the time we live in, as alluded to in the very beginning, it's very selfish, very self-centered. Read the Gita and it says we should become selfless. Does that in itself have a determination on our health and well-being?
Well, on the one hand, so the question has to do with attitude. Does that have much to do with our health and well-being? Well, if our attitude toward our health and well-being is passive and that we take our health and well-being for granted, then that sets up certain causes that are going to just roll on themselves. Sometimes, even the simple ideas that we grow up with, that the doctor said this, therefore do it, puts us in a certain frame of mind that it's not for me to question why. Mine is just to do it. So perhaps to keep a check on that, our attitude, to be proactive, to ask why, and to participate, at least participate in decisions regarding healthcare with the professionals, may keep a check on passivity.
Can we ask for further clarification? When you say attitude, do you mean our motive?
Yes.
Primarily,
yes.
As opposed to our maybe philosophical orientation, or you mean our motive? And so the driving principle of motive is our aspiration and desire. And we've already presented chief in the one of the chief laws of mental health, mental balance, is to bring into activity the power of will. Will is always there, but it's colorless, Mr. Judge tells us. And behind will stands desire. That means the will, we may have the motive to do something, we may have the intention of doing something, but without the will, it just remains in our mind as a well-intended thing, but we don't carry it through. So the will needs to be generated. And very often it's generated by strong desire. But strong desire in a selfish way, or for the purpose of gratifying the senses or the desires of themselves, brings about our achievement, but very often to our detriment. Too much activity, too much concern for possessions, too much concern. We become workaholics or addicted to many other things besides substances, which set up an imbalance in our nature. But if our motive is high and pure and desire, it brings in the will, the spiritual will, in such a way that we are able to better stay on that path without being distracted, and we are able to keep in our minds the high ideals we have. Just think, try to formulate in your mind the highest ideal you have, and then notice how quickly it can flitter away unless you sustain it. So to sustain it, there has to be the desire to sustain it, which brings about the will. Yes?
And Mr. Judge's one-page preference to the Ocean of Theosophy, he mentions that the will, the subject of will, is not covered. But then he does talk about the will for about half a paragraph, and it's very instructive.
Yes.
As to the nature of the will, and but why is so little about the will? We're always told to develop the will.
Yeah. Because he says there in that preface that the will itself is hidden and not manifest. So it's hard to discuss it. We can only discuss its effects by which he had. Now, there is another book in which he goes into discussing the will, and that's his introduction to Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms. He goes into it a little more deeply there in the introduction, because it relates specifically to the material presented in that devotional book. But for the purposes of expounding on the inner and unseen dimensions of the will and the audience he had, he didn't see that that was useful for that particular work.
However, in the preface, he does qualify it. He doesn't just say, well, we're not going to talk about the will. What he says is, more or less, it's not productive to talk about the will outside of dealing simultaneously with desire. We would have to check exactly how he discusses that, but mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes?
Well, the English language, we say we understand words. We use a lot of words without even thinking about what we have said. So my comment now is on that phrase, duty is the talisman. Everyone's heard that term before. Duty. Is it? Well, what's my duty? And we see that it's a material aspect of our life that we pay more attention to. Here we learn what our true duty is. And the word talisman, could you explain? Duty.
Explain. We're not familiar with the word.
Okay. Well, there's that expression, duty is the royal talisman. So what's a talisman? What's your understanding of what a talisman is? Yes?
It's a reminder, something to... I remember when we were in Boy Scouts, we were supposed to carry a coin in one pocket, and then after we did a good deed, we switched the coin to the other pocket. So in a sense, it was a reminder to do good.
Mm-hmm. So a talisman might be a charm or a token, which you said acts as a reminder of what to do, but also it's supposed to have certain powers and influences that bring about certain effects. So it's almost a charm in that sense. And although in the West, Western civilization, where we have sacrificed our in tuneness with the psychic and hidden dimensions of nature, for the favor of the developing of the intellect and physical aspects of civilization. We've lost touch with that, but in many cultures where that closeness with nature and that attunement with nature is prevalent, such as in the Native American cultures of this continent, they have direct and practical knowledge of the potencies of common materials in nature, rocks, stones, leaves, and that a certain material object in a certain context, in a certain place, will have a completely different influence than in another place. It's a whole science, as we would understand the word. So duty is the royal talisman in both sense, because keeping in our mind what is it we should do is a reminder. What am I doing now? I'm not just acting out of impulse or habit, but I'm trying to remember what I should be doing. But it's also a potent protector and influence, because if we just did our duty alone in the moment with the right motive and not being concerned about the results, it would not only bring about the lawful results of our actions, but aid us in our higher spiritual and mental development and health as well.
Yes.
There's cultures around the world where laying on of hands or the oral expression of mantras and various musical tones bring about healing to a person. How is it that works?
So the question is, how is it that the laying on of hands and musical tones or saying mantras can bring about at least the subsidence of symptoms, if not healing? How does that work? Well, with what we've read, the particular mechanics we couldn't speak to. However, tradition tells us Pythagoras said that the music can be very healing. Harmonious music can be very healing. So right there, just the fact that he would use the word harmonious, there's something along the lines of doing it in accordance with nature's laws. One would have to know those laws. The laying on of hands, there's the transfer of vitality. That's not mind, but the vital nature. We can't talk about, we couldn't say the mechanics.
Carry forth the ideas just presented of the laying on of hands, as said, is a transfer of a certain energy, psychic energy, regardless of what we want to call it, from the healer to the patient, as an actual physical transfer of forces and atoms, which can have a beneficial effect. Mesmer developed this to a high degree in animal magnetism, and also later in the mesmeric passes that he would do over a patient, because he recognized that cosmic magnetism is the tendency of that things of a like nature repel one another and things of an opposite nature attract. And by this magnetism, you can influence the polarity of a body. And you can do it with sound too, because sound affects the polarity of the elementals. And through both ways, you can influence the forces in the body so that those tendencies, those lives that are disruptive will be repelled, and those that would be beneficial would be attracted. So the use of certain objects, certain metals, certain natural compounds. We think the whole science of homeopathy, which HPB speaks about, is based on this fundamental knowledge of the inherent magnetism in even the smallest amounts of very common substances, that the whole idea of like attracts like, as opposed to allopathy, which is based on the opposites, the antagonism of opposites.
Yes.
So it is true then that for a period of time we saw many patients being told to visualize colors, to purple, and in fact being one to heal. So colors therefore have a specific vibration.
Mm-hmm.
So the vibration is what we're filling ourselves with.
Mm-hmm.
So by imagining that, I guess being not a specific form of concentration, more of still very abstract to visualize a color.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that is looked upon theosophically as being a benefit and not being really
if anything that it would seem anything that we're doing deliberately to clear or clean, to clarify our mental nature is setting up, an environment where we can promote our health. So the issue is to treat an illness, treat the illness on its own nature. Certainly theosophy would not say don't take physical medicine for a physical problem. But as regards the visualization of colors, etc., we don't think that that's a problem if one is meditating and mindful and observant of what one is doing. Now, whether or not purple is the right color, who's to say? But things like that, it seems like it would be a step in the right direction just to test it for yourself.
And so just the whole idea of color, well, we know that there are departments of psychology that investigate color and the effect it has on the mood, productivity, and health. And every once in a while you see in journals and in the newspaper articles that certain scientists say that a certain color should is very soothing and productive of health. And we've noticed that in some clinics and hospitals they'll go out special efforts to paint the walls and ceilings and decorate in certain colors which are known to be healthful and healing. So there's a science there, at least when it comes to the physical effects. But what scientist and even a layperson trying to meditate or focus on, what do we understand about the psychic effects and influences of colors imagined in our minds? Because these effects go beyond the physical. We're told that color influences the elementals just as sound does. And so where we may actively use the mind to visualize color, do we really know the effects they have? So there's not much we have in the teachings of Theosophy by HBB and William Q. Judge that we find in our books on the book table and so forth that give us any definite instruction about the visualization of colors, although we are told generally that the use of the imagination is best accomplished by keeping it on its own plane And the plane of the mind is not sense. The plane of the mind is thought and ideas. So when we bring the mind down to color, it's really bringing it down to a lower level, it would seem. And so it's better to focus, if we're going to use the imagination, focus it on the highest ideals and the highest thoughts, keep it on its own plane.
So bringing it down to the lower level, it sounds like it's the world of the elementals. And so we're told not to dabble in that, because without knowledge, we're not going to get good effect.
Mm-hmm.
But we were wondering, we hear about a lot of warnings about hypnosis, and self-hypnosis is mentioned occasionally, and that's, we're told not to, but we're wondering, like, what's the difference between the two, and why the warning against self-hypnosis? There's an awful lot out there, a lot of people that are, you know, there's tapes, there's books, there's all kinds of things on self-hypnosis, and it sounds very benign, but we're just wondering, what is it, a matter of degree, or is there grave danger in self-hypnosis as well?
Well, if hypnosis by an operator puts one in a passive state and receptive to the suggestions of that operator, which is warned against, as we all know, by theosophy, then self-hypnosis is putting oneself, if self-hypnosis is putting oneself in that passive state voluntarily, what is it that we're being receptive to? It would seem self-hypnosis is different from meditation, which is a healthy internal work. It's all part of the Raja Yoga. But self-hypnosis in terms of a mantra may leave us open to other forces.
Well, we think part of the issue then, there's a large understanding. What do we mean by self-hypnosis? And we think the answer just given relates to the specific practice of putting oneself into a hypnotic trance. So one is in a passive state where they can be just as receptive to their own thoughts in a passive way as to anybody else. It makes very little difference whether it's the operator doing it or you're doing it yourself. But we see in our popular culture that self-hypnosis is usually nothing more than the power of suggestion. Repeating to yourself certain ideas over and over and over again, which is basically self-advertising or self-manipulation or self-suggestion. Now, that can be very helpful if the thoughts and ideas we're suggesting to ourselves are useful. So somebody comes up to us and asks us for help. Well, there's two ways you can do it. You can be very dogmatic and affirmative, as this is how you do it. This is the, you know, this is the way it's done. Do it this way. And you can imagine the different kinds of results you might get from that kind of approach. Maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong, but it deprives the individual of certain things they can do to find out for themselves, or it engenders a certain kind of dependence on them, or maybe resistance. Versus making a suggestion. Well, have you ever thought of doing it this way? Or, you know, I've had the same experience, here's what I found that's helpful, you may want to try it. Or if it's a theosophical area, you give somebody a reference. In other words, you make a suggestion. Suggestion's very important, and you can repeat the suggestion. Isn't that what we do week after week? We remind ourselves of certain, suggest to ourselves certain truths to bring the mind up to a higher level. Yes?
Well, we have a library. Do you ever stop to think of what the word library means and the literature that has been provided for us? Isis, Chakra, the Ocean, and numerous other literature places. Well, nature, when she sees us in the library attempting to understand her, she says, my most beloved, even though he's dead. Poor dead bones. He worships me with the sacrifice of my mass. This is my result. We have so much literature, yet we're trying to use our own acquired, most material approach to ideas that we miss the mark. We are most grateful and put in our proper level. We realize that here in the library and in the programs we run twice a week, if we let go of who and what we think we are and read that declaration independent, then we may have some idea. It seems that our opportunity to present these ideas to those who come in who are confused. What does independence mean? Why did this happen to me? I want to know. Then we run away. So the physical aspects of mind that we talk about and bring in Brothers and Bailey introduced us to in the 19th century. Stop and think. When you see on the door independent devotion, that's exactly what.
Anybody know the Latin meaning or the word library?
Well, we can only guess that it comes from the word liberal, and a classical liberal education is to be well informed in many, many areas and subjects. So without actually looking it up, it's,
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting, this part of the second object of the Theosophical movement in its practical realization was to gather together books. HPB speaks about this in the key, from all over the world that were on these subjects. And we have a library here in the lodge, and we have books available on the table so everyone can have their personal library. And maintaining a library is one of the fundamental obligations of a ULT, not just the presentation of the material and the sale of books at cost, but to have a library. So we were thinking that if man is made of thought, and man does not live by bread alone, then the library is the kitchen and dining room for the mind. It's where we go to find mental nourishment. And depending on what you read in the library, you can find spiritual nourishment as well. But too much reading of books, Judge warns us, can lead to mental indigestion and problems as well. Too much reading, not enough thought. So we'll stop here, and next Sunday we're going to enter a new theme, practical theosophy, and our first Sunday meeting will be on theosophy in daily life. Our meeting's adjourned.